Hi, listeners, it's Vanessa. Before today's episode, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Crime House.
Most of us recognize red flags, like an acquaintance who tells wild stories that never quite add up, or a partner's problematic behaviors. Kenneth Regan was a walking red flag, but he knew how to keep those warning signs from fully registering. First, he charmed. Then, he manipulated. Then, when that stopped working, he was never afraid to take what he wanted by force. And Kenneth's willingness to cross any line ultimately led him to commit one of the most brutal crimes the United Kingdom has ever seen. The human mind is powerful. It shapes how we think, feel, love, and hate. But sometimes it drives people to commit the unthinkable. This is Serial Killers and Murderous Minds, a Crime House original. I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And I'm forensic psychologist Dr. Tristan Ingalls. Every Monday and Thursday, we uncover the darkest minds in history, analyzing what makes a killer.
Crime House is made possible by you. Please rate, review, and follow Serial Killers and Murderous Minds. To enhance your listening experience with ad-free early access to each two-part series and bonus content, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Before we get started, be advised this episode contains descriptions of violence and murder, including the murder of small children. Please listen with care. Today, we conclude our deep dive on Kenneth Regan, a money-hungry career criminal who'd do anything to rise to the top. Kenneth's greed was so powerful, he was willing to betray and manipulate everyone. And when there was just one man left in his way, Kenneth turned on him in the most shocking way possible.
As Vanessa goes through the story, I'll be talking about things like how some offenders continually try to manipulate others even after multiple failed attempts, how they react when the people they have been manipulating turn on them, and the psychological fallout of money-obsessed offenders losing everything.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what makes a killer? In February of 2003, 50-year-old Kenneth Regan lured his boss, Anil Chauhan, to his father's home just outside London, where Kenneth also lived. The two men had met in prison, and for the last few months, Kenneth had been trying to convince Anil to sell his company, Seba Freight Services. Even though Anil had given Kenneth a steady job as a truck driver, Kenneth wanted more, so he lied to Anil and told him he had a group of investors willing to pay millions to take over the company. In reality, Kenneth wanted Seba for himself. He saw it as the perfect opportunity to rebuild the drug smuggling enterprise he'd lost when he went to prison. He could use the freight to transport drugs and launder his earnings through the company. The only problem was, Anil wouldn't agree. He wanted to sell the business, just not to Kenneth's supposed investors. So on February 13th, when the two men arrived at Kenneth's dad's house, two of Kenneth's criminal associates, William Hornsey and Peter Rees, were waiting there, ready to ambush Anil. Over the next several days, Anil was held captive at Kenneth's father's house. While many of the details of what happened to him remain unclear, Anil was gagged and bound, drugged, and forced to sign forged documents that appeared to give Kenneth Regan full control of Seba Freight.
This is an extreme escalation. Kenneth went from financial manipulation to abduction and captivity. He's become more morally disengaged, but also continues to justify his actions. It's highly likely that he's framed these actions as necessary rather than criminal, especially when we consider how important it is for him to live a particular lifestyle and how within that lifestyle, he's accustomed to instant gratification. This is likely one of the first times that Kenneth has encountered someone who held firm on their boundaries, who couldn't be manipulated or, quote, bought, even if it was with fake money. In terms of motivation, it's often not just one factor like entitlement or desperation, but a combination of both of those things. Entitlement can create the belief that he deserves what Anil has, and desperation adds the pressure and the urgency of needing it now. When those two factors exist, extreme actions like this are more likely to result in someone like Kenneth.
Does Kenneth seem genuinely delusional about what he could get away with?
Based on what you've described, and of course without having met or evaluated him personally, I don't see any clear evidence of a delusion in the clinical sense. A clinical delusion is a fixed false belief that a person holds despite clear evidence to the contrary, and it's typically associated with severe mental illness. I think what we see here instead is behavior that appears goal-directed, organized, and strategic. He's using deception, planning, and other people to achieve a very specific outcome. That kind of behavior usually suggests that the person understands the rules and is trying to work around them. Because if he truly believed everything he was doing was legitimate, there would be less need for secrecy or manipulation. There's also not obvious signs of psychosis in the behaviors described. So this appears to me better explained by overconfidence, distorted risk perception, and a belief of invincibility. As we discussed in episode one, when someone repeatedly engages in high-risk behavior and avoids serious consequences, it can reinforce the belief that they're smarter than the system or capable of outmaneuvering others. And in this situation, Anil doesn't appear to come from the same kind of entrenched criminal environment, which may have made him seem like a more approachable or vulnerable target to begin with from Kenneth's perspective, and also why he's so insistent on seeing this through instead of finding his next con. This rejection may be hitting Kenneth in his ego. Otherwise, why not just let it go, you know?
Well, as drastic as Kenneth's actions were, they were only the beginning, because he knew that in order to avoid suspicion, he needed to create a false narrative around Anil's disappearance. So when Anil's wife, Nancy, started to worry after he didn't come home from work, Kenneth was ready. He'd already made sure to tell SIBA staff that Anil had been called away on an urgent meeting in Holland. So when Nancy called the office looking for him, that's what they told her. But that didn't sit right with Nancy. She knew Anil better than anyone, and she knew he wouldn't leave town without telling her. Soon, Nancy's gut instinct was confirmed when she realized that Anil's passport was still at home. However, Kenneth must have been thinking one step ahead, because later that same day, Nancy received a recorded message from Anil assuring her he was okay. But this also raised red flags, because in the message, Anil spoke in English, whereas he and Nancy always spoke to each other in Punjabi. Now Nancy knew something was wrong. Unfortunately, she didn't realize how serious the situation was. She told her brother, Onkar, what was going on, but she didn't contact the authorities just yet. However, Kenneth started to realize that she would call them eventually, and he couldn't let her do that. So on February 15, 2003, 2 days after Anil's abduction, Kenneth paid a visit to the Chauhan family's home. He brought William with him while Peter stayed back to guard Anil. Kenneth and William drove a rented van to the Chauhan's house. When they got there, they introduced themselves as Anil's associates, which was enough to be let inside. But once the door closed behind them, the situation turned unimaginably violent. Inside the home, Kenneth and William turned on the entire family. They immediately murdered his wife, Nancy Chauhan, her mother, Charanjit Kaur, who was visiting from India, and the couple's two young sons, 18-month-old Devinder and 8-week-old Ravinder. Afterward, Kenneth and William carried the bodies through the backyard and loaded them into the van. They returned to Kenneth's house, where he shifted his focus back to Anil. He forced Anil to sign more documents and even a few blank sheets of paper. The entire time, Anil's deceased family was right outside. It's unclear whether Kenneth told Anil what they had done, but once Kenneth believed he had everything he needed from Anil, he murdered him too. Now that the entire Chauhan family was dead, Kenneth thought that Seba Freight was his. 2 days later, he called his friend Belinda Bruin in for her first day of work. Kenneth had hired Belinda to replace Anil. She didn't know about all the atrocities Kenneth had committed to remove Anil from the company, or what Kenneth planned to do with it once Anil was gone. But now that he was finally out of the picture, it was time for Belinda to take over, with Kenneth pulling the strings.
This is horrific, and it highlights how strongly he viewed Anil and his family as obstacles to his ultimate goal. His desire to take over Seba was so central to his thinking that he was able and willing to dehumanize his entire family, including a toddler and a baby. And when violence escalates to this level in a context like this, it's often the result of a narrowing of options in the offender's mind. So in Kenneth's case, the plan appears to have required total control over the situation, meaning control over the business, the paperwork, and the people who could expose what was happening. Once the situation started to unravel and it became clear that Kenneth's weak narrative wasn't satisfying Anil's worried wife, Nancy, he likely felt Anil's family would complicate his plan. So what likely happened was tunnel vision under pressure, where he became so focused on his outcome, his thinking grew rigid, and violence became the solution. Violence is also likely a go-to solution that he's been familiar with in the environment and lifestyle he's chosen, and he's been exposed to for decades now, and that can narrow his thinking even more.
Like you said, horrific. How do offenders mentally rationalize violence against children?
That's a really important question. And in cases like this, the same processes I talked about earlier tend to be involved. Things like dehumanization, moral disengagement, and emotional detachment or compartmentalization. These are psychological mechanisms that allow someone to create distance between themselves and the harm that they're causing. Instead of seeing a child as an individual with their own life ahead of them and their own future, they may start to see them in terms of their role in the situation. And that's they're a connection to the target or an obstacle. That shift in perception can make it easier in their mind to justify the violence. I can also speak to this from experience. I worked with individuals serving life sentences for many years, and within prison culture, there's often a very strong informal code against crimes involving children. Many of the men I worked with would say that they could never justify that kind of violence, but when I taught victim impact awareness, we talked about the ripple effect of crime. Over time, some of them began to recognize that their actions actually did harm children, even if it wasn't directly. For example, if their victim was a parent, those children were in fact harmed by their actions because they now had to grow up without them. And that realization was often very powerful. That was actually one of my favorite groups to run because a lot of really meaningful work was done there.
Even though Kenneth had finally gotten what he wanted, he still had to get rid of the evidence tying him to the multiple homicides. So a few days after the murders, Kenneth, William, and Peter loaded the Chauhans' bodies and drove to Belinda's 50-acre property in the countryside. William and Peter had already dug a 12-foot-long ditch on the property and told Brenda it was an irrigation trench. She could tell they were lying to her, but she didn't witness what they did next. Under the cover of night, the three men buried all five family members on Belinda's land. When she returned home, it just seemed like the man had finally refilled the hole like she'd asked them to. After that, Kenneth had one last item on his checklist. He gave Anil's car to an unnamed associate who likely broke the vehicle down and sold it for parts. Now Kenneth thought his plan was complete. He could move forward with his smuggling operation, and within no time, he'd be sitting on a mountain of cash. But while he basked in his success, other members of the Chauhan family started to sense that something was terribly wrong. Nancy's brother Omkar lived thousands of miles away in New Zealand, but he spoke to his sister and mother regularly. Nancy had told him she thought something had happened to Anil, and when Omkar didn't hear from her or their mom for a few days, he got worried and called the authorities in London. Omkar told them about his sister's worried phone call a few days earlier and told them he hadn't heard from her or his mother since then, but the police weren't convinced there was anything to investigate. Investigators struggled to imagine that an entire family could just simply vanish. They assumed there was a harmless explanation. Since Charanjit had been visiting from India, they figured the whole family probably decided to go back with her for a visit. Omkar tried to explain how unlikely that was, but the police still wouldn't listen. And since he couldn't shake the feeling that something was terribly wrong, he decided to do something about it himself. On March 5th, 2003, about 3 weeks after the murders, Omkar flew to the UK and headed straight for Nancy and Anil's house. When he got there, his fears were confirmed. Not only was the house empty, but there were a handful of signs that they hadn't been planning to leave. First, everyone's passports were still there. Then, when Omkar checked the laundry machine, he found wet clothes still inside. But most troubling of all was his mother's prayer book. She never traveled without it, but it was still sitting in the guest room. To Omkar, the state of the house showed clear signs that the Chauhans had vanished against their will. For all of Kenneth's planning, he had no idea how many clues he'd left behind.
As we discussed earlier, Kenneth appeared to show strong entitlement and narcissistic traits, which can contribute to an illusion of mastery. In other words, he may believe that he thought of everything and that this plan is airtight or that he can outsmart the people around him. That confidence can feel very real to him, even if it's not realistic. We also talked about how his thinking seemed to become more rigid and narrowed leading up to these events. When someone develops that kind of tunnel vision, their focus shifts almost entirely to the desired outcome. And with that narrowed focus often comes reduced caution because they don't fully consider the possibility that they could be wrong or that others might notice what they missed. So ironically, the very traits that make someone feel powerful and in control can also make them more prone to careless mistakes. They may believe they've planned meticulously, but that inflated confidence and that narrow focus can cause them to overlook the obvious.
Kenneth likely believed he'd thought of everything, but now Omkar had what he needed to convince Scotland Yard to take the missing persons case seriously. And when investigators conducted their own search of the Chauhans' home, they agreed with Omkar's suspicions. The family clearly hadn't left on their own accord. As the investigation gained momentum, detectives would soon uncover even more dark and mysterious clues, including one from Anil himself. By the end of March 2003, Kenneth Regan and his associates, William Hornsey and Peter Rees, had killed the entire Chauhan family to gain control of Seba Freight Services. With the business now in Kenneth's hands, the men got it ready for international drug smuggling. Kenneth was driven by a single goal, to make as much money as possible. But there was one thing he hadn't anticipated, how fast people would begin to catch on. Kenneth had no idea that Scotland Yard was investigating the Chauhan family's disappearance, but he did quickly realize that top company officials at Seba Freight were suspicious. People were starting to talk about how strange it was that Anil had suddenly left, and a lot of those people knew he had no intention of leaving the company to Kenneth's friend Belinda. As the chatter grew, Kenneth tried to get ahead of the situation. In late March, he gathered up three of the blank sheets of paper that he'd forced Anil to sign and printed letters on each one, which he then sent to various company members. The letters explained that Anil and his family had grown tired of their life in the UK and simply decided to walk away from it all and return to India. But once again, Kenneth had failed to see the flaw in his plan, because each recipient noticed the same thing. The letters were typed, but Anil always wrote correspondence by hand.
Trying to control the narrative after a crime is extremely common. On a practical level, it's about avoiding suspicion. They will do whatever they can to distance themselves from the crime, divert attention, create confusion, or buy time. But for some individuals, especially those who place a high value on power, status, or control, the need to manage the story can be about feeling like they're still in charge of the situation. And of course, there's impression management, which we talked about in episode one, where people actively shape how others perceive them. In everyday life, we all do this to some degree, but in criminal contexts, it can become more extreme. They may construct elaborate explanations or false timelines or stage scenarios to preserve the image they want others to believe. Generally, though, it's often a mix of both practical reasons and a need to remain in control.
Do you think someone like Kenneth might find enjoyment in manipulating the story in the aftermath of his crimes? And if so, what does this suggest about how his brain chemistry might work?
In some cases, they do get a sense of enjoyment or excitement from manipulating the story. But based on what you've described, I don't necessarily see that as the primary driver for Kenneth. His behavior, at least to me, reads more as desperation. If his plan and his lifestyle or even his sense of identity were tied to money and success, which is now tied to the success of the scheme, then losing control of the situation could feel like a major personal threat. In that context, he may have been operating in more of a survival or self-preservation mode, which he's done before, because he's scrambling to maintain control and avoid consequences. That state is typically driven by fear and urgency. However, if someone like Kenneth were to succeed in regaining control of the situation, that could feel very different psychologically. Success might reinforce feelings of entitlement or superiority and inflate his sense of self-importance. Manipulating a situation successfully can activate the brain's reward system, including dopamine pathways, which can produce feelings of relief, power, or even temporary victory. In that sense, it would be enjoyable then. But more often, though, it's the sense of regained control that feels rewarding. But currently, I really think Kenneth is operating under pressure and threat rather than pleasure.
When the authorities learned about the suspicious letters, they felt even more confident that someone out there knew something and was intentionally covering up the truth. So they started looking into Anil's business. And that's when they learned how Belinda Bruin had suddenly been appointed as the new managing director at the behest of one of Anil's newest and most controversial employees, Kenneth Regan. After learning this, detectives quietly started collecting business documents. They even got their hands on Kenneth's laptop without him knowing. However, as they searched for clues, Kenneth seemed to realize that he hadn't done enough to stop the law from closing in. He decided that if he really wanted to throw them off his scent, he'd have to get rid of the main pieces of evidence, the bodies. So on April 19th, 2003, 2 months after killing the Chauhan family, Kenneth, William, and Peter returned to Belinda's property and dug up the remains of all 5 family members. They transported the bodies to a dock, where they loaded them onto a boat and ventured into the English Channel. It's unclear how far they boated into the channel, but the men threw each body overboard. Kenneth thought he'd finally covered the whole thing up for good. But again, he'd overestimated himself, because 3 days later, a body surfaced in the water near Bournemouth Pier, about 80 miles from Belinda's home. After the police were called, the remains were quickly identified. They belonged to Anil Chauhan. The husband, father, and businessman was confirmed dead. Now authorities had to figure out how he'd died. And although his body was too decomposed to clearly determine the cause of death, there were signs of strangulation, which suggested that Anil was killed before his body was disposed of. Then, right when it seemed like that was all the information they could glean, someone in the ME's office discovered a jaw-dropping clue. While handling Anil's clothing, they felt something inside one of his socks. They took it out and realized it was a piece of paper folded into a tight square. And when they unfolded it, they saw that even though it had been in the water, the tight folds had preserved the ink. It was still legible. It was a piece of mail addressed to Kenneth Regan. Now, it was clearer than ever that Kenneth likely had something to do with Anil's death. Police came to believe that Anil had put the letter in his sock on purpose as a way to leave behind a clue into his own murder.
In situations where someone realizes that they may not survive, the brain can shift into a last resort problem-solving mode. Even under extreme fear, many people retain a strong drive to protect others or to make sure the truth comes out. You sometimes hear about victims leaving DNA under their fingernails or disturbing the scene in ways that later become evidence. Those actions can be purposeful in more ways than one. The person may recognize that escape isn't likely, but they still have some control over what happens next. By leaving evidence, they're trying to influence the outcome after they're gone. By helping investigators or protecting their loved ones and increasing the chances that their offender is held accountable. And as mentioned earlier, Anil has already shown signs of distrust toward Kenneth before the abduction. So that suggests he may have become more vigilant than usual. When someone's threat response has been activated over time, they can become more mentally prepared for the possibility that something is wrong, even if they hope it never escalates to that extreme. So leaving that clue was likely not a sudden random act. It reflects a combination of fear, awareness, and an effort to maintain some sense of control in a situation that Anil likely felt very powerless in.
With the discovery of Anil's body and the note he'd left behind, the investigation intensified. As the authorities ramped up their efforts to find the rest of the Chauhan family, people who knew Kenneth started rethinking things they'd brushed off over the past several months. One of those people was none other than Belinda Bruin. About 10 days after Kenneth and his men had retrieved the bodies, she noticed that the hole had been dug up again, and she promptly called the police. Belinda told Scotland Yard investigators about how Kenneth's associates, William Hornsey and Peter Rees, had dug the hole without her permission about 2 months earlier. She explained that they'd also filled it back in without letting her know. Now that the hole was re-dug, investigators had a hunch that the men had buried the bodies there. So by the end of April 2003, investigators were combing through the hole in search of evidence. They found clothing and jewelry that they were able to confirm had belonged to Anil. But that wasn't all. They also obtained DNA samples. And when they got the results back, they showed matches for multiple Chauhan family members. Investigators lost all hope that they'd find the rest of the family alive, but they still had to find them, so they released the story of their latest developments to the media.
From a psychological standpoint, Belinda's decision to come forward likely reflects a shift in her internal cost-benefit calculation. When someone realizes that they may be connected, even unknowingly, to something serious, the risks of staying quiet may begin to outweigh the risks of speaking up. In this case, the activity was happening on her property, and that alone could create a feeling of personal vulnerability. So she likely recognized that coming forward is the safer and more responsible option. There's also a strong drive toward self-protection and moral alignment. If someone sees themselves as a law-abiding or ethical citizen, but suddenly feels entangled in something potentially criminal, that can create significant internal discomfort, and that's where cognitive dissonance comes in. When a person's situation conflicts with their self-image, it creates internal tension. Reporting what they know can be a way to resolve that tension, both legally and emotionally, by bringing their actions back in line with their own values. So her decision to name Kenneth to police was likely influenced by a combination of self-protection, evidence on her property, and the need to restore her own integrity and control.
How do you think someone like Kenneth would react emotionally or psychologically to realizing he'd lost control over someone he'd been manipulating?
What likely makes this even more significant for someone like Kenneth is who Belinda was to him in his mind. As we discussed in episode one, he seemed drawn to her status, her credibility, social connections, and legitimacy that he didn't have on his own. So if he viewed her as a social icon or gateway into a more respected world, her role in his plan was likely as symbolic as it was practical. She was a part of the image he was trying to build for himself. And when someone like that turns around and names him to the authorities, that's a personal blow and an ego injury. The very person who was supposed to elevate his status and help maintain his image has now exposed him and contributed to his downfall potentially. Psychologically, that's going to trigger humiliation, betrayal, or rage, especially in someone whose self-worth is tied to status and control. And it can challenge a belief that they're in charge or that people will fall in line or that they can manipulate others successfully, especially now when he's already being challenged by law enforcement.
Once the news broke, Kenneth did the only thing he could think of. He ran. He and William fled the UK, traveling first to France and then on to Spain. Peter Rees went a different route, hiding out with a friend in Gloucestershire, about 100 miles from London. Clearly, he didn't go far enough, because on May 14th, police tracked him down and arrested him at a local pub. As the investigation continued, officers searched the home that Kenneth had been sharing with his elderly father. Inside, everything was spotless. But in the backyard, investigators found something that Kenneth had missed, a single drop of blood on a garden wall. The DNA results were heart-wrenching. The blood belonged to Anil's 8-week-old son. Investigators believed it was a sign that the infant boy had not survived, and if Kenneth Regan was willing to murder a child, that probably meant he'd killed the entire family. Their beliefs were further confirmed a few weeks later, on July 15th, when a fisherman discovered Nancy's body. However, Kenneth hadn't been home when detectives searched the premises, and now they couldn't find him or William anywhere. Detectives started tracking the men's bank accounts, as well as Anil's, after learning that Kenneth had gained access to it. Soon, they realized that both men had fled the country. Scotland Yard launched what would become one of their biggest manhunts in history, spanning multiple countries, all with a single objective: to find Kenneth Regan and William Hornsey, then hold them and Peter Rees accountable for the unthinkable violence they'd committed. And pretty soon, Kenneth's love of money would prove to be his undoing. By August of 2003, Scotland Yard was in the middle of what would become one of the largest manhunts in its history. Investigators had successfully captured Peter Rees, but the international search was still on for Kenneth Regan and William Hornsey. While Kenneth was in hiding, his world started closing in on him, and fast. He couldn't access his own bank accounts or Anil's without being tracked, and every move he made cost money. It was becoming increasingly difficult for him to stay hidden, and when he eventually ran out of money completely, there was nowhere left to run. On August 2nd, after months on the run, the man who had spent his life obsessing over wealth, status, and a lavish lifestyle was found hiding out at a campsite in Belgium with almost nothing to his name.
Knowing what we know about Kenneth, him being found at a campsite with almost nothing left can be an identity collapse. The image he had constructed of being powerful and connected and in control no longer matches his reality. And that gap between his self-image and his actual circumstances can be very disorienting and destabilizing. And for some individuals, moments like that can bring forced confrontation with reality, and that can create feelings of shame, defeat, or emptiness. That said, not everyone experiences that kind of moment as a turning point. Some people double down on their existing beliefs or they blame others for their circumstances. But whether losing everything like this actually leads to insight or change will depend heavily on the individual.
For someone like Kenneth, would losing money hit harder than the threat of prison?
I think it's reasonable to say that financial loss may carry more psychological weight for someone like Kenneth, especially because he's been to prison before. When a person's already experienced incarceration, it's familiar. It's restrictive, of course, but it's also structured. He's got basic needs like food, shelter, and clothing that are all provided, and the lifestyle is relatively predictable, but it's constrained. What often creates more psychological stress is what happens after prison. Many people who are released find that they've lost jobs, housing, relationships, and their social standing. They're not picking up where they left off. They're starting from the ground up. That loss of status and stability can feel more threatening than the confinement itself, especially for someone whose identity is tied to status or wealth or control and success. So for a person like Kenneth, the idea of losing everything financially may represent a deeper, more personal threat than prison alone, because it means losing the lifestyle and the identity that he spent years trying to build. At the same time, though, this situation is different because if he's facing multiple murder charges, the stakes are much higher and prison may no longer be a temporary setback. It could represent the rest of his life. And for someone who is highly control-oriented, that's a permanent loss of autonomy. That can also be very psychologically significant. But the loss of money, status, and identity may have been a more immediate and personal threat, especially given his history and the life he seemed to value. And now it's a loss that will likely be indefinite, but something tells me that that reality hasn't hit him yet.
Thankfully, Kenneth didn't put up a fight as he was taken into custody and officially charged with murder. Then, about a month later, on September 7th, William Hornsey, also worn down by life on the run, willingly turned himself in. With his surrender, the multi-month international manhunt finally came to a close. Shortly after William was taken into custody, another grim discovery was made. The body of Nancy's mother, Charanjit Kaur, was found on a beach, further confirming the full scale of the men's crimes. With all three men now behind bars, formal charges followed. Kenneth Regan and William Hornsey were each charged with 5 counts of murder. Peter Reese was charged with the murder of Anil Chauhan and preventing the lawful and decent burial of a body. Still, despite the mounting evidence against them, all three continued to deny any involvement. They insisted they were being wrongfully imprisoned. For Kenneth, the man who had spent his entire life believing he would outsmart everyone, there was now nothing left to control except the version of the story he chose to tell himself.
There are a number of reasons why people like Kenneth and Peter and William might maintain their innocence even when the evidence against them is substantial. The most practical explanation is legal strategy. They may have been advised to assert their innocence or to plead not guilty. They may be hoping for a plea bargain, or they may be thinking ahead to potential appeals if they lose a trial. But denial can also serve an important psychological function, especially in a case like this involving, you know, the killing of an entire family, including children. Crimes against children carry a particularly strong moral stigma in most cultures, and they're often seen as some of the most unthinkable and unforgivable acts a person can commit. That means the gap between the accusation and the person's self-image becomes even wider. So by insisting they didn't do it, they don't have to fully confront the moral weight of the behavior. Denying this protects their ego, their identity, and the version of themselves that they still want to believe in. Admitting guilt would require accepting a very different and very unforgivable self-concept. For some offenders, that's psychologically harder to tolerate than maintaining the denial, even in the face of strong evidence. And in Kenneth's case, it's hard to say, but it's more likely than not a mixture of both. He does have a pattern of behavior that suggests he prioritizes self-preservation and image. But again, he wants to control, like you said, the version of the story that he chooses to tell himself.
Do you think someone like Kenneth, like specifically with a psychological profile like Kenneth, ever be able to admit guilt?
It's hard to say. I've seen offenders with similar profiles maintain their innocence for the rest of their lives. And I've also seen cases where people make confessions at the very end. Because at the end of life, some individuals begin to reflect on their actions. And for some, that creates, you know, space for admission or remorse or a desire to unburden themselves. But to others, that's also still about image management, because the true intention can be less about remorse and more about absolving themselves of guilt because of maybe faith-based beliefs that they have or fears about what will happen to them when they do pass away. And then there are others who hold on to their denial until the very end. That denial may be so intertwined with their identity that admitting guilt would be too intolerable, or it's survival-based. Again, having to live in an environment where crimes against children are not accepted is certainly a motive to deny it in itself. So there's no single predictable outcome, really. It often depends on the individual, their personality structure, their coping mechanisms, and their motivations.
After a long and meticulous preparation, the case against the three men finally went to trial. By 2004, Kenneth, William, and Peter weren't just facing a courtroom. They were up against extreme public outrage for what they'd done. The scale of the crime and the brutality behind it had shocked the entire country. As a result, prosecutors made it clear from the start that they intended to leave nothing to chance when it came to keeping the men responsible behind bars. When the trial kicked off, prosecutors laid out what they described as Kenneth Regan's motive and grand plan, which they pieced together from his history of drug smuggling and the fact that he suddenly took control of Seba Freight after the murders. They told the jury that Kenneth planned to take over the company at any cost and then use the business as a front for international drug smuggling. They said the murders weren't random or impulsive, but calculated. And they presented evidence they'd obtained from Kenneth's laptop, including forged documents. Finally, the prosecution presented Kenneth and William's cell phone location data, which placed them with Anil on the day he disappeared, and then at the Chauhan family home when the remaining family members were murdered. But the defense told a very different story. In a surprise admission, Kenneth's attorney said his client did help dispose of Anil's body, but that he only did it because an Asian crime gang forced him to. They said the gang operated in the same criminal circles as Kenneth, and that they'd chosen him to carry out their dirty work. They also challenged the prosecution's financial motive, pointing out that there was no meaningful profit to be made from the alleged drug scheme that would justify such extreme violence. The trial stretched on for 8 months. When the jury finally reached a verdict on July 1, 2005, the case had become the longest murder trial in the history of the Metropolitan Police Department, with costs estimated at around £10 million. Inside a packed courtroom, none of the three defendants showed any real sign of emotion as the verdict was read aloud. All three men were found guilty. Sentencing followed soon after. First, Peter received a sentence of 23 years for his role in Anil's murder. But before handing down sentences to Kenneth and William, the judge took a moment to describe both men as highly dangerous individuals who should never be allowed freedom again. He went on to sentence each man to 5 life terms with whole life orders, meaning they would never be eligible for parole and would effectively live the rest of their days in prison. For Kenneth Regan, the man who'd spent his life chasing wealth, status, and control, it was the end of the road. After destroying an entire family, his life of crime was finally over.
I know I touched on this before, but the reality that he cannot outmaneuver consequences and he will never have a fast life of luxury again can be an identity fracture for someone like him. This can lead to a range of emotions, and with some individuals becoming more withdrawn or depressed, while others doubling down on denial, blaming others, or finding a new purpose and a source of control while incarcerated. Some offenders begin to reconstruct a new inner narrative. They may shift from seeing themselves as powerful or superior to seeing themselves as victims of circumstance, being misunderstood or even morally justified in their actions, which it sounds like he already tried with his defense. Others, though less commonly, may eventually develop insight or remorse as they process the permanence of their situation. That said, the reality of never being free again can be extremely destabilizing. I've seen this firsthand with many offenders, particularly in their initial adjustment periods, which can range from months to years. But at the same time, human beings are highly adaptive. Many long-term incarcerated individuals eventually did build new identities around routine. They got roles within the prison community, or they built personal belief systems that helped them make sense of their new circumstances. Of course, that's not the case for all, but it truly depends on the person, their previous experiences, personality traits, insight, and coping mechanisms.
How might the men's sentences affect the Chauhan's loved ones? Do you think long sentences, especially life sentences or multiple life sentences, does that offer closure for the family?
This is such a complicated question, because if you were to ask a survivor or family member, you'll get a different response each time. I've seen individuals sentenced to life who are part of the restorative justice program attempt to make amends with their victims' families or their victims, and they get mixed responses, with some being receptive and others not. Some families do get closure, and they find a sentence like this to be justice or validation. Others never do, because in truth, nothing's going to bring their loved one back. A sentence doesn't erase that loss or the grief that comes with that loss. So while it can offer a sense of security or safety because they're behind bars for the rest of their life, and it's certainly an acknowledgement of what's been done to them and their loved ones, they don't always bring the kind of emotional closure that people expect. Healing tends to be a much longer, more personal process that's shaped by each family's relationships, their beliefs, and their support systems, which, if you really think about it, is absolutely understandable.
Though the Chauhan family ultimately received a measure of justice, the bodies of the two Chauhan children have never been recovered, leaving a painful absence that no conviction can ever resolve. Nancy's brother, Onkar, has long believed that the police were too slow to recognize the seriousness of what had happened. He's openly criticized what he sees as a lack of urgency in the early days of the investigation, time that could have stopped the criminals from tampering with evidence and ultimately fleeing. As for Belinda Bruin, she was never found to have any involvement in the crimes themselves. Authorities ultimately concluded that she had been manipulated by Kenneth Regan and drawn into his orbit without fully understanding what was unfolding. However, now that there was clarity around the case, the authorities decided to revisit another old, unsolved mystery that they thought Kenneth and William might have been involved in, the 1992 disappearance of businessman Michael Shalimach. While working the Chauhan case, investigators had noticed the unsettling similarities between Michael's disappearance and Anil's, like the letters that appeared after both men vanished, with each claiming to have left voluntarily. So in 2016, Kenneth and William were identified by police as official suspects in Michael's disappearance. However, there have been no new developments in the case since then, which means Michael's case remains unsolved. To this day, neither Kenneth nor William has admitted responsibility to the murders of the Chauhan family. But in the end, their silence and multiple attempts to obscure the truth couldn't hold up and proved that they're not cut out for the very life they'd been chasing. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next time for a deep dive into the mind of another murderer.
Serial Killers and Murderous Minds is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. Here at Crime House, we want to thank each and every one of you for your support. If you like what you heard today, reach out on Instagram at Crime House. And don't forget to rate, review, and follow Serial Killers and Murderous Minds wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback truly makes a difference.
And to enhance your listening experience, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You'll get every episode of Serial Killers and Murderous Minds ad-free, along with early access to each thrilling two-part series and exciting Crime House bonus content. Serial Killers and Murderous Minds is hosted by me, Vanessa Richardson, and forensic psychologist Dr. Tristan Engels, and is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. This episode was brought to life by the Serial Killers and Murderous Minds team: Max Cutler, Ron Shapiro, Alex Benedon, Lori Marinelli, Natalie Pertsovsky, Sarah Camp, Sarah Batchelor, Marky Lee, Sarah Tardiff, and Carrie Murphy. Thank you for listening. Hi, listeners, it's Vanessa. Before today's episode, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours.
Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.